You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
This is the Royal Blue Podcast from the Liverpool Echo, giving you the inside track on all the big talking points from Goodison Park.
Hello and welcome to a brand new episode of Analyzing Everton with me, David Hughes, and of course, Josh Williams. Josh, it's been a while, certainly on this show anyway. How are you, mate?
I'm good, mate. Yeah, it has been a while. Been talking about Liverpool for a few weeks without really looking at Everton, so it's good to change tack a little bit.
Yeah, I actually can't remember the last episode we done. I think, was it just before lockdown, potentially?
Yeah, maybe, yeah. But I think the good thing is that obviously a lot's happened in a week since, so I'm sure we'll get into it this episode.
Yeah, that's it. It kind of feels like, I don't want to use the term glory, because we're not at a stage where we're celebrating glory, but certainly feels like we've reappeared at just the right time when, there's plenty to be excited about for the season ahead. So today in the show, we'll obviously be talking transfers because there's been three fairly big ones for Everton over the last week or so. They look a much better outfit ahead of this campaign, so we'll have a chat about that. We'll also have a talk about the new Premier League season and, of course, Tottenham, which is coming up on Sunday. I know it's only game week one, but it kind of feels like a big game with it being away from home against the top side. So we'll have a chat about Spurs and Everton's prospects in that game, and then we'll just finish up by touching on Everton's prospects in the campaign as a whole. How do we think that they'll get on? Hopefully it could be a good season, but we'll come to that a little bit later on. Josh, we'll start with maybe just getting your thoughts on Everton's transfer business so far. There's been a fair bit that's happened. How would you summarise your opinion on what they've done to date?
Yeah, well, I think it's interesting. I mean, they've signed certainly one player that didn't expect them to buy. But if you look at the business, I think there's positives and negatives to it for me. It's nice to focus on the positives, which I'm going to do, but I do think there's downsides to the deals. But I think firstly, very clearly an immediate improvement on what was there before. And arguably the biggest area of need in the Everton squad has been comfortably tackled with three additions, really. And all for around a total, I'm led to believe by yourself, for less than 60 million. Is that correct? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'm definitely not an in the know by any stretch of anyone's imagination. But yeah, luckily we speak to people who are in the know, and that's it. We're kind of led to believe that. It may even be a lot less. There's talk of, James Rodriguez, or James Rodriguez, I should say, coming on a free transfer. I don't know. I haven't had that confirmed by anyone. But yeah, we're looking max maybe around 60 million all in for the three players.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at how Everton's midfield has been in particular in the past 12 months, it's barely even there, really. It's quite, there's zero presence, really. Players in, square pegs, round holes, I think they call it. But I think these players should add certainly a presence. I think there's a physical capacity to the three players, which is good. When it comes to getting around the park and, just basically having a presence in the centre of the field. But when it comes to the downsides, my biggest issue with Everton's business, and this has been the case for a while, is that they're probably going to have to do all this again in about 2 or 3 years. I think that's the biggest downside to it. They seem to, in terms of thinking about the medium and long term of the health of the squad, it just never really seems to be considered that much. There seems to be, for me, a little bit of an impatience when it comes to getting towards the business end of the table as quickly as possible and almost skipping steps in the process to get there quickly, which is, you know, understandable. You know, the ambition's clear. But I think sometimes when you take those shortcuts, sometimes it can bite you, basically. Now, these are three clearly good players, proven players at a solid level. It's just a case of, as I said, mainly that Everton will probably have to phase these players out or buy replacements for these players inside 2 or 3 years, as opposed to, you know, maybe 5 or 6 years of service, which would be more ideal.
Yeah, you know, and I mean, let's address that point really from the outset, because it is a fair point. It's something that I touched on as well a couple of weeks ago, or, you know, a week and a half ago, when these deals were on the horizon. Because you've signed a 27-year-old, a 29-year-old, and a 29-year-old. So there is that obvious concern of basically you could be lumbered with players like Everton seemed to be at the moment or last year. I think the positive, and I thought what they really got correct with these deals, was the money that was paid. It felt like there was a few lessons learned in comparison to the 2017 summer. If you think, they paid 45 million for Gylfi Sigurdsson. So that was 3 years ago. Gylfi Sigurdsson's 31 now. So that was, testing me, Matt, he was around 28. So you pay 45 million for a 28-year-old. I think I can't remember what the deal was for Ashley Williams as well. I know he come in around the same period. You know, Steve, they had the track record of kind of buying players who were already in the peak and probably coming out of it at the wrong side. But as I said, that being said, I thought the deals were really clever. If we look at James Rodriguez, it was basically like a 2-year deal with the option of a third, which I think that's dependent on how many times he plays in the second season. But for me, I see that as, if the move turns out to be a disaster, you're only basically stuck with him for 2 years. I don't think it will be, but I just think that's it's a lot more clever business, I'd probably say, Josh, from an Everton point of view, compared to maybe previous times.
Yeah, I agree with what you're saying there. I think in terms of getting value out of these deals, they are much closer to the value side.
Yeah.
You know, those deals of the past. I've just checked Ashley Williams for you there. He actually signed for apparently 12 million. I'm not sure how old he was at the time, but yeah, Probably was past his peak. But yeah, I think what I'm saying is, you know, you don't necessarily have to go and sign endless players who are 21 years old. But it's just a case of, you know, if you sign a player who's 25, either side of 25, you know, whether that be just 24, 26, something like that, they've still got the peak ahead of them. They might be able to offer you about 6 years of service if they're kept, and if they're not kept, they've got resale value there. I think the issue with the players that Everton have bought is that they will be with Everton until they regress. They might be difficult to shift, and when they do regress, they're going to need replacing. But, you know, I agree with what you're saying. I think the James Rodriguez deal in particular is interesting in terms of the years on his deal, because you could argue that, you know, Decore, Rodriguez and Allen, you could argue that the best player there is James Rodriguez. But at the same time, he's got the shortest deal, and it's probably the lowest price as well.
Yeah.
So, I think in terms of minimising risk, I think Everton are definitely tackling that side.
Yeah, definitely. But it does look to be, you know, a huge upgrade. If you think last season, Ancelotti came in and was mainly due to injuries, but he's largely reliant on Tom Davis, Andre Gomez, Gylfi Sigurdsson, and Morgan Schneiderlin within his midfield. I actually thought Schneiderlin, when he played, i.e. when he was fit, was pretty reliable. Actually, he's probably, for me, you know, people might laugh at this, but he's probably Everton's best midfielder in that kind of period. Thought Sigurdsson really struggled to adjust to playing deeper. And Gomez and Davis were just, in my opinion, poor. I know Gomez was coming back off an injury, but they really struggled to kind of build a forceful midfield duo. So it felt like Everton were kind of finishing the campaign after lockdown with no midfield. And I think that's one of the reasons why they struggled so much. So, you know, the players that they brought in, we'll touch on them now. We'll start with Allen. should definitely immediately upgrade the side. And then, you know, hopefully whilst this season goes ahead, while these players are still, you know, top players, Everton can look at kind of identifying the next set of targets that they can hopefully, you know, be a little bit younger, have that kind of prime years ahead of them, resale value and all those kind of other variables. But for now, I think there's definitely been an upgrade. Josh, we'll talk about Alan first. How much have you watched of him? How much do you know of him? And in your opinion, I suppose, what do you think he'll bring to Everton's team?
Yeah, I've seen him quite a few times, to be honest. He's obviously, I'm a Liverpool supporter, and we've faced Napoli quite a few times over the years, and I've always been really impressed with him, to be honest. I think there was one match in particular where he completely bossed the midfield. He was everywhere. And I think he's that type of player, really. He's almost, I mean, whether he can still do it at 29 remains to be seen, but he is almost that player who can do the run for two players. It's like you've got two players on the field as opposed to one. Quite adaptable as well, very industrious. As I said, he's got an engine about him, but he's also good on the technical side as well, which I think offers an insight into how well rounded he is. I think he's one of them players who he doesn't really have many weaknesses. He's maybe not an expert when it comes to anything specific, but he's kind of the jack of all trades sort of thing. And it'll obviously help from a tactical perspective as well, because, you know, regardless of whether Ancelotti's going to stick with the 4-4-2 or if he's going to move towards using, you know, vertical number 8 or something like that, Alan can do both, really. He can do whatever midfield role you ask of him, really, unless you're asking him to maybe be a bit creative, then he may be forced down a little bit. But in terms of a well-rounded midfielder who will tackle much of what you've been lacking, I do think it's a good addition, yeah.
Yeah, totally agree. And under Maurizio Sarri at Napoli, you know, we focus on that kind of 17-18 season. He was a number 8, as you touched on there, in a 4-3-3. I thought it was interesting. He contributed that season with 4 goals and 3 assists, and there was something like 0.9 shot assists per 90 as well, which kind of captures, you know, okay, they're not remarkable numbers, but it does show that he kind of could impact the game in the attacking third if he was a little bit higher up the pitch. But yeah, obviously, then Ancelotti comes in, Napoli switched to 4-4-2, and following the same, Alan kind of undertakes a more disciplined role, tasked with, you know, breaking down opposition attacks, more so than them trying to support his team in their own attacks. I think if you look at those numbers, what really stands out is, you know, being quite a relentless and forceful presser of the ball. It feels like every team needs that, don't they? You talk about, obviously, being a Liverpool fan, you think of Fabinho, you know, he's fantastic at that. I thought, you know, there was few better in the game than Idrissa Gueye. Everton didn't replace him. Okay, they brought Gbamin in, but due to his injury, he was just basically an invisible man last year. And you do need that figure. And whilst I don't think Alan is a natural heir, I don't think they're, you know, the exact same player. I think whilst Gbamin's still trying to get fit and get into the side, I think we might see Alan kind of play that role, I guess. And with him being, you know, familiar with Ancelotti's system as well, I feel like he's going to be the ideal candidate to sit deepest within this new look Everton midfield.
Yeah, I mean, as I said, he's very mobile player. From whatever I've seen him, he's, you know, quite an industrious player. So in terms of committing a few men forward, he should be able to provide quite a platform, really, for Everton to attack, for Everton to get some players forward. I thought it was interesting, though. I looked at last season. He didn't play that much, really, did he? In terms of, in comparison to his previous years,
seen that? Yeah. Was it around 1,400 minutes, something like that?
Yeah, it was something like that. Yeah, every now and then, the odd little random issue. Like, I'll get it up now, but if you want to fill the space, but
yeah,
I'll get it up now.
Yeah, I wasn't sure whether there was something to do with once Gattuso come in at Napoli. I just don't think he particularly favoured him, or he wanted to go a different direction. Or I don't know if there was a few niggling injuries in there as well. But I just think that can happen sometimes, can't I?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the injuries that he's got, that it's got down for him on transfer market is muscle fatigue, which is, you know, not one that you usually see very often. And I decided the muscle fatigue. He was featuring, but maybe half an hour periods every time. So, and he had a slight knee issue, apparently a bruised rib. Very random injuries, really.
Do they, to you though, reading between the lines, do they seem like the type of injuries you'll only pick up when you're not really in favour or not really enjoying your football? And, you know, it's just, I feel like if you're playing in the side week in, week out, you tend to kind of play through that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, they don't look like long-term issues by any means.
Yeah. So that's the kind of hope there that, you know, it would be a case of perhaps... with it being that, you know, clearly not in favour with Gattuso, that it was kind of easier not to play or not to force injuries, and all that, he's probably going to be moving on in the summer. But look, on the whole, I think it was a good move, and I think you said it right at the top of the show how important the midfield is, how important it was getting that midfield fixed this summer, and I think he's going to be someone who's definitely improve that area. And another one that will move on. Go on, sorry.
I was just going to say, I think what these signings do, especially Alan as well, I think they move Everton towards the realms of being really competitive in every match, really. I think that's what these signings have done. Okay, they're quite relatively short-term deals, but in terms of getting Everton competitive, particularly in the middle of the park, you know, they're going to have quite a significant impact on that if you can get Alan, Decore and James Rodriguez playing every single week.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. We'll just with you mentioning, then we'll move on to Decore. You know, he's a player who's kind of been in Everton's scope for feels like a couple of years now. I'm not sure if some of that was down to Marco Silva, but he said himself, you know, this is the club it's the only club I've wanted to go to. I've been trying to move there for a while. He's the youngest as well, which is quite surprising because feels like he's been around for a while. But he's still just 27. I know that's prime years, but it's still not a bad age to bring him in. Only 20 million paid, which I thought, okay, I know Watford got relegated, but I thought, again, that was a good price for them. Not that you'd be wanting to pay upwards of 30, because I feel like you'd be overpaying, but I just think Everton, you know, paid for what he's worth. Premier League experience, big and powerful. Kind of looks, I guess, like the perfect partner for Alan for the time being. I don't know if you agree if they are sticking with the 4-4-2.
Yeah, I mean, I can actually see Decore and Alan being vaguely similar to Decore and Kapui for Watford in terms of just being a double pivot, but a double pivot that has real presence, lots of mobility, aggression, all that sort of stuff, physicality and all that sort of stuff. So you know that they're playing, you know that you're in for a game. And I think, to be honest, when you mentioned before that you've signed a 29-year-old, a 29-year-old and a 27-year-old, I had to check who the 27-year-old was, because I actually thought they were all 29 for some reason. I'm not sure why I thought that. So because he's 27 and you've got him for, I think on the verge of 20 million, It really isn't that bad of a deal, and considering his strengths on the game, you know, he's a good forward runner, late arrival into the box and stuff like that. But a bit like Alan, in terms of he clearly got quite an adaptable skill set in terms of moving around different tactical systems and stuff. Clearly had a presence in the air and stuff like that. Interesting little move.
I mean, you've touched on some of his kind of assets there. You know, we're talking about a 6-foot midfielder. He's big, he's strong, he's what you call a powerhouse, I guess would be the best term. He's also really aggressive and pressing, similar to Alan. But, you know, despite being so big and strong, he is really mobile, which is quite rare, I think, for, you know, players who are that kind of build, I guess. Good at carrying the ball. We know he's a decent ball carrier. You mentioned that little caveat about the arriving late in the box. It's a really good point, and you know, he has kind of really chipped in with some output over the last three or so seasons. He scored or assisted 22 Premier League goals in that time, which, okay, again, you know, not stunning numbers, but if you think about it for a central midfielder, and then if you compare it to the output of Everton's midfielders, you know, over the last year or two, there's only really, I'd say, Sigurdsson who might be able to come close to that. And Sigurdsson obviously takes most set pieces and penalties. So you're kind of bringing a player in who can bring you a lot of mobility in the middle, big presence, good ball carrier, strong in the air, but also a player who might be able to chip in with the odd goal as well, which is always welcome, isn't it?
Yeah, well, again, just similar to Alan in terms of being a bit of an all-rounder, really. One of them players who doesn't have many weaknesses but seems to tick most boxes to a fairly decent level. In terms of his output there that you just mentioned as well, I was actually looking at that as you were saying that. And maybe not last season, obviously, Watford suffered relegation. They had about four different coaches or, you know, all this sort of stuff. The season before that and the season before that, so 2017-18, and 18-19. He scored 7, assisted 3, and the following year scored 5, assisted 6. So that's 2 seasons in a row there that he's added at least 10 scoring contributions to his team, despite playing in midfield. Mm. Now, if you put that into context in terms of, like, you know, what that's probably worth in terms of points, you know, he's adding a fair amount there, and despite playing in midfield, you know, 10 scoring contributions per season for your centre midfielder. You know, we can't really argue with that.
Yeah. Yeah, we've said on maybe on this show, maybe on another show, we talked that there's a general consensus amongst kind of football statisticians that, you know, roughly a goal amounts to a point across a season. So if you think that he's contributing, you know, 10 per campaign, you could potentially argue that he's earning an extra 10 points. As I said, we know it's not, you know, it's not that black and white, but that kind of captures the influence you can have, and hopefully that the influence he can bring. Because, you know, for Everton, as I said, there hasn't been that real influence in terms of goals within the middle for a long time. And it's probably worth adding on to Corey, Josh, that unless maybe you have any information contrary to this, I don't think he takes any set pieces, did he, at Watford? Or he didn't take any, sorry?
No, I'm pretty sure he took none.
And it's no penalties.
No penalties, no. But it's probably worth adding as well that I think there's a general perception of midfielders in England because of the likes of maybe, you know, Patrick Vieira and Steven Gerrard and Frank Lampard especially. You know, these players contribute a lot on the attacking side for their teams. You know, back in the peak Barclays Premier League years and stuff like that. But on the whole, if you look, you know, throughout Europe, most central midfielders don't actually do an awful lot in terms of direct scoring contributions. Like in terms of actually providing assists and actually scoring goals, most the large majority of midfielders don't really offer much on that side. They might offer some progression and the pass before the assist and all that sort of stuff. But in terms of the Corey, obviously he's offering assists and goals, as we just captured there, to about a 10-pair season. You know, it is a bit, I don't know, maybe unique is the word in comparison to most centre midfielders out there, if you consider that the sample will be about, I don't know, maybe around 200 across Europe's top 5 leagues.
Yeah. Yeah, the appeal is clear to see, and I just think it was another good piece of business. And Everton have got 2 really good central midfielders there now. It does actually make you think, before we move on to James Rodriguez, it does make you think, you know, I don't know what your opinion is, but what I wonder what the future holds this season for the likes of Gomez and Davis if they stick around. Because for me personally, I couldn't see Gomez kind of, or Davis partnering either of those two players and bringing anywhere near the same impact, I guess, is probably the best term. What do you think on that?
Yeah, it's tricky. I mean, I don't think it necessarily has to be. I mean, are you suggesting maybe that they should be sold or something like that? Or?
I'm not. I'm just, I guess I'm just saying, I'm almost, you know, drawing a line in the sand in that they now know that they've got to work extremely hard to get back into the seventh side for me. You know, where they were kind of guaranteed to be started last season. I just think it's very rare that you buy a player and you're like, this player should be starting from the outset, and whoever was in that position, especially central midfield, whoever was there last year, should be immediately relegated to the bench, and the emphasis is on them to get back into the side. But I do think it's quite unique this year where I believe that these two probably should be, whether Sunday might be a little bit too soon, but these two should just be considered Everton's starting two in the 4-4-2 now. And the likes of Gomez, I've got to work hard to get back into the side.
Yeah, I mean, Tom Davis, you know, the English homegrown, still only 22 years old. I wouldn't have much of a concern around him, but I think Andre Gomez in particular, obviously he's 27, is supposed to be his peak. I just think, like, you know, we just mentioned then in terms of, you know, quantifying the Corey's output on the attacking side in terms of what that might be worth in terms of points. I think Gomez is just, he's a good footballer, but in terms of what he does for his team, moving them towards winning, adding points, having a difference towards the goal difference on the defensive side and the attacking side of his team, he just feels a bit, I seem to use this term quite often with you, Dave, but he seems to be just a bit beige. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, he's neither here nor there, really. He's not like above a 5 out of 10, not below a 5 out of 10.
Yeah.
But crucially, as I said, in terms of adding goals, making a difference to your goal difference, adding points to a team, Gomez just feels a bit like a bit of a ghost.
Yeah.
And I think the Corey and Alan will offer a bit more on that side, a bit more presence, a bit more difference in terms of impacting the results of Everton's team.
Yeah. For me, Gomez has bypassed too easily without the ball. But then he's also not really doing enough with it. I think on his day, he can be a really good passer. He'll try a few penetrating balls, but over the course of a season, he doesn't do that nearly enough, and that's the issue with him. But, you know, I do want to keep the podcasters. I mean, don't get me wrong. I love it to be objective. I don't just want it to be all, you know, everything's fantastic and rosy, because I think you can get that everywhere else, and that's not what we do on this podcast or any other show we do. But I do want to kind of keep up with the positive themes if possible, seeing as it's been a good week. So I'll move from the misery of Gomez to James Rodriguez, which feels like a big signing, to be honest. Josh, feels a bit like a marquee one. You know, it's really hard to try and articulate what I'm trying to say more beyond that it just feels huge. It just feels a really big sign.
Yeah, it is, and it's one of those signings as well that kind of goes beyond the pitch as well, like it's in terms of the commercial side and all that sort of stuff, and what it signifies in terms of, you know, quote, ambition and all that sort of stuff. It is a big deal, yeah. You know, a top performing James Rodriguez, you know, the peak performing James Rodriguez starts for the vast majority of teams in Europe comfortably. So if Everton, you know, if Ancelotti can get that out of him, can get back to that level, you know, he's a serious player.
Yeah, it kind of feels like this is what. I mean, I suppose you could put Alan in this bracket, but this feels like a sign, and that was really thanks to having Ancelotti as your manager, because you couldn't.
Yeah.
I don't think you could say Everton would have got James Rodriguez if Marco Silva was still in charge. Now it feels like you've brought in a real big name on the back of having a real big manager, which you know, for any concerns we had about Ancelotti at the time when he was coming in. Although we had a lot of positives to say, of course, you know, we had some concerns, but this is certainly one of the positives in that what he can bring is just, you know, it's in many ways, it's next level to what Everton have been used to in recent times. But obviously the important thing is how he does on the pitch. Maybe we'll touch on availability and stuff in a little bit, but just in terms of playing in the Everton side as a fit James Rodriguez, how do you see him featuring, Josh?
Firstly, just on Ancelotti there, mate. I think that influence of a manager and being a draw for players is definitely a thing. You know, if you look at the players that have signed for Manchester City over the past few years, okay, there's a lot of money involved, but how many of them have said it's to work under Pep Guardiola? I think if you look at United's business since Ferguson left, and maybe the names, the really talented names who have turned down United in the past few years, you think of Erling Haaland, players like this. I think Jude Bellingham as well. That doesn't happen if Ferguson's in charge over Solskjaer. You know, we've seen that at Liverpool as well. Obviously, don't want to use Liverpool as an example on an Everton podcast, but Jurgen Klopp brought some serious players to Liverpool over the past few years that, despite suffering from competition from rivals at the time. So, yeah, I think in terms of Ancelotti, this is one of the main perks of getting him in, basically the absolute draw that he's going to have on players who maybe in a different scenario would look the other way.
The Royal Blue Podcast from the Liverpool Echo.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
It's such a good point, to be honest. I'm glad that you flagged it. It is so true. You know, the examples you used, I thought my United was a really good one there. If United had Guardiola, Klopp, someone like that in there, you know, would these same deals that they've missed out on have happened? You think they would? Even Sancho now, you're led to believe that basically Sancho hasn't forced the move through with Dortmund, which is one of the reasons why it's happened. Amongst other things, there's other variables with costs, etc. But you believe if United had a truly elite, big name manager there now, that Sancho would, as an English player as well, he'd be desperate to get to United. I'm not saying I'm pretty sure he still wants to go there, but you do feel like that would have maybe been the thing that pushed him over the edge. And yeah, Ancelotti in many ways has kind of put Everton back on the map in a lot of places. And this is, you know, bringing in James Rodriguez is really thanks to him. Obviously, we give Brands credit as well, but just in terms of sell him this project, it's down to Ancelotti. Let's go back to what we're going to talk about, Josh. How we see him featuring.
It's an interesting one because obviously we've already mentioned quite a few times the 4-4-2. Now, I have always personally seen James Rodriguez as a 10. A very nice 10, I will say. So not the traditional 10 that you have to maybe carry. I think James Rodriguez is kind of in the mould of like a... I think Mourinho said once that his number 10s have to be an 8.5 without the ball and a 9.5 with the ball. I think James Rodriguez fits that bill, really. I think he has a real ability to blend scoring and creating at the same time while also being active on the defensive side. Speaking of his creation, Dave, have you seen his shot assist numbers?
No, I don't know them off the top of my head. I think I have seen them, and I'm pretty sure they looked insane, but were they just... was the caveat of there was fairly low playing time, like low sample size, or?
Yeah, well, I mean, over the course of the past 6 seasons, he's played 8,000 minutes. So, three of those seasons at Real Madrid. Sorry, four of those seasons at Real Madrid, two of them at Bayern Munich. So, obviously, he's benefiting there from having the ball. But over that 8,000 minute period, he's averaging 3.4 shot assists per 90. For perspective, that's a lot. I'm going to get up De Bruyne now. I know off the top of my head, Trent Alexander-Arnold is posting about 2.5. Kevin De Bruyne, since over the past 7 seasons, so 5 of them at Manchester City, 2 of them at Wolfsburg, De Bruyne is averaging 3.4 shot assists per 90. What did I say Hammers was?
It was both 3.5, wasn't it?
Both
3.4. I mean, they are huge numbers. You know, that's impressive. Yeah. And if you think, come on.
I was just going to say, to be honest, I'm quite surprised. I didn't know he was. I knew he was good, obviously. I knew he was a scorer and stuff like that. But in terms of being creative, I didn't know he was doing that much for his teammates in terms of presenting them with shots.
Yeah, I think if you can go on FB Ref, if anyone ever, you know, wants to know where there's some sort of free good data, he has some really good shot creating numbers there as well. I also shared, actually, if people want to go on at DA Hughes _, you'll see, you know, I shared a radar, one of 23's radars on him, and he just looks ridiculous. They basically compare his numbers to, you know, players in the same positions across Europe. And, you know, he's basically maxing out most metrics. He's top talent. I can't remember where we up to. Go on.
So how do you actually see him fitting in then, Dave, in terms of the tackle side? Because, you know, in a 4-4-2, obviously, unless it's a 4-4-2 diamond, obviously there's a bit of a, you know, where does he fit?
So for me, I've kind of backed him to feature as almost like on the right of Everton's attack. So, you know, like the 4-4-2, he plays on the right. And again, I hate using Liverpool references in Everton podcasts. It doesn't feel right. But on this occasion, I think it's worth flagging. I see him almost playing like a Coutinho role. Albeit I know Coutinho was playing in a 4-3-3. But you know the way Coutinho was playing on the left, but he tended to kind of cut in, occupy those like half space areas, positions in between the defence and midfield. That's what I can kind of see him doing. I'd say on the right for two reasons. One, because Everton don't really have a great right side. They've only got Theo Walcott, who's the only real natural right side of the attacker. And secondly, Rodriguez is left footed. So it kind of works perfectly for him to be cutting in onto that left. Obviously, he won't be a traditional wide man. You won't see him, you know, driving at speed down the line and then looking to swing crosses into the penalty area. That's not his game, but you'll probably instead see him, I guess, acting a bit like an advanced playmaker, you know, just cutting in. And then we've just touched on his kind of chance-creating abilities. So, you know, maybe he'll be looking to thread balls in, crosses into the box, or unleash shots on goal because, you know, he's got a fantastic shot from distance. So there's a few options, but I think right now, if he stays 4-4-2, he's best suited as a right side of the attacker.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you just mentioned there about the prospect of a diamond. I do think a diamond would be interesting, you know, with Everton's current team. So if you pitch, obviously, a diamond allows you to play a number 10. It allows you to play with a front two. And it would allow for Alan and Decore to both kind of operate as kind of like, you know, the number 8 in the diamond system, the shuttle and midfielders. Up and down, that sort of vibe. The only issue with that would be, obviously, your reliance on your fullbacks to provide the width. Lucas Digne will be fine doing that, but on the right side, I still think Everton are looking for a right back, aren't they?
Yeah, that's correct. Right? Yeah,
yeah, yeah. And on the whole midfield position, I'm not really sure. Say, for example, let's go for the diamond. If you go for the top, so you've got Calvert-Lewin and Richarlison up front. Rodriguez is the 10. Alan and Decore is 8. Who plays the 6? Plays the deepest role?
Yeah, so we've talked about that a little bit this week. And in an ideal world, you're looking at Gabannon, because that's his profile, isn't it? And if he can come in and get fit, then that's your midfield. Gabannon, Alan, Decore, Rodriguez at the tip. And I do think that's a really strong diamond. But the problem is, Josh, you don't know how good Gabamon is. You know, how good do you retain from like an 18-month layoff in a new league already? It's hard to kind of bank on this player. to come back and be what you need from that kind of, I guess you call it a number six role. So then if you can't get him fit, can't get him in, I can't think who the other candidate is to kind of play that position. That's the problem with the Diamonds.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, the players that you've got to play with there, really, you haven't got a lot. You've got Tom Davies, you've got Andre Gomes, you've got Fabian Delph, maybe, somewhere.
Delph's not a bad shout. You know, Delph, for all the dislike amongst Evertonians for Delph, which I get, you know, it's not always on the pitch. It's the fact he never plays, always injured, and he was a little bit mouthy once on social media, which upset a few people. But all that aside, Josh, he's not actually a bad player, you know. Like, he's probably one of Everton's better midfielders.
No. I looked into numbers while we were in lockdown, and we had absolutely zero football to talk about. And this is just one of the random avenues that I explored. But I explored two-footedness, so which players use both feet quite frequently. And Fabian Delph's actually the most two-footed player in the league. I looked in the Bundesliga. He would have also been top of the Bundesliga. I should have done the whole year, but I actually think that he might be the most two-footed player in the whole year, Fabian Delph, which is, you know, takes some doing. But I do think that his decision-making sometimes is a bit erratic. He can be a bit stupid sometimes, can't he? Overcommit sometimes.
That's it. You kind of want your player in that position to be really reliable. But it is interesting, though, you can... If you're comfortable on both feet, then I think it just opens up your kind of vision, I guess, and your capabilities in terms of your passing range. So Delph could be an option, but the problem with Delph is he's just never fit. No, never available. And if you're never available...
I will add as well that the perks of the Diamonds, you also don't... You don't then have to play any wide attacking players. And I think if you look at Everton's attacking players in the wide positions, I'll be honest, mate, I hate them. I think they're really absolutely toothless on the attacking side. At least you've got Theo Walcott, you've got Bernard, Anthony Gordon, okay, he's learned the trade. You know, you're going to be considering him. I think Iwobi has struggled since he's came to Everton. So I think playing a Diamond would allow you to completely remove those positions, basically.
Yeah.
I just think it's an interesting little prospect that Ancelotti might play with.
Yeah, no, it is. And obviously the width is then provided by wing-backs. And we don't know what the score is with right-back, but we know, you know, left-back, Everton have one of the better left-backs in the Premier League in Lucas Digne. So kind of, you know, you can rely on him. So the Diamond is appealing. It may come. There's also the option of potentially even the, you know, people have been talking about a 4-2-3-1. Maybe you could go down that route. And that kind of just leads us on to crucially just pointing out that the good thing with these purchases as well is there's a lot of versatility in terms of playing roles, isn't there? It feels like Everton had a squad basically built for 4-2-3-1 when Ancelotti come in, which meant some players just struggled to adapt to a 4-4-2. But all three of these players could potentially play a couple different roles in different formations, which could be important as Ancelotti could end up changing his setup, you know, further down the line.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like Everton have been buying for 4-2-3-1 for a few years, but yet they're still not playing the system for whatever reason. Just a note on James Rodriguez as well, I forgot to mention before. I mean, he seems to he's a consistent overperformer, you know, on the XG side.
Elite player, mate.
Yeah, well, there you go. I mean, since over that six-season sample that I mentioned, so, again, 8,000 minutes, he's overperformed by 17.4 goals.
That's good.
Every season, he overperformed 6 seasons ago by 7. Then by 4, then by 2, then by 2, then by 1.5. And then last season, obviously, only played about 400 minutes for Real Madrid and was virtually level with his expectations. So he's one of them players, again, who, you know, most people know him from that World Cup goal for Colombia. He is kind of that player, really, who can put the ball in the back of the net despite being presented with difficult difficult shot locations.
Yeah, definitely. And you know, I joke then, but we do always say, don't we, that if you see if players are consistently overperforming, over certainly over sample sizes like that, compared to the XG, then it's not luck. It's because they're really good finishers, you know, really good shot takers. And maybe if we have time, we can have a look at kind of his post shot XG numbers, and just, you know, further down the line and see. Because what you find, don't you, is if post shot XG dramatically increases on XG, then it's normally down to a player's kind of elite finishing levels. Mason Greenwood immediately stands out. He does that quite well. He seems to overperform against his XG, but when you can look at his post shot XG, you see that, you know, it increases substantially thanks to his own abilities. But just before we do move on, in short, it's, you can see the appeal with all three, can't you, Josh? And it's kind of been, okay, let them, we've talked about the potential concerns, but we focus solely on just what they'll bring to the side this year. It's three good buys, isn't it?
Yeah, as I said at the top of the show, I think it's a very clear improvement on what was there before. And the most important thing is that it tackles probably Everton's biggest areas of need and brings them to a level whereby they are competitive. That midfield is good enough and capable enough to compete with any Premier League team, really. And I think that's the main thing here that we've got to focus on.
Yeah, really, really good line to finish that little segment off on. So we'll leave it there. Move on to Tottenham this Sunday, first Premier League game. We've spoken about this already, Josh, but it's come round quick, hasn't it?
I needed more of a break, personally. I'm glad it's back.
Yeah, it's one of them. It has come around quick, but at the end of the day, it's, you know, it's our hobby, our bread and butter in terms of our work and life. So it is good to have it back. Obviously, Everton go to Tottenham. Now, Everton actually haven't won against Tottenham in 15 league games. I mean, that kind of continues the theme of just all-around poor records against traditional top six sides. Tottenham, obviously, under the stewardship of Jose Mourinho now. I thought it was interesting when I was doing a little bit of research on them that since he came in November, Tottenham actually finished fourth. If you just basically limit the games to the ones he was in charge, it was maybe 20-odd games. But yeah, in the table, Tottenham were fourth. I think Southampton were fifth, which was also quite interesting. But then if we have a look at expected points in the table and expected points for that same period, they actually ranked 11th below Everton. So I thought that was quite interesting, Josh, that, okay, they clearly got the results, but maybe the performances weren't there, and there might have even been a little bit of fortune to kind of pick up the points that they did.
Yeah, I think you've just summed up there, really, in terms of separating the results to the performances, which I think Mourinho has been, it's what he's always done, really. I think I wasn't actually aware of them placing fourth, but then 11th for expected points. That was something I was unaware of, but I don't know, so maybe you can put a bit of that down to how Mourinho's game changes tactically once he gets a lead, sort of thing to hold on to, or that sort of thing. Obviously, if Spurs are, you know, having to go at a team and they take the lead and stuff like that, maybe Mourinho is inclined to basically stop attacking. And if the other team continues to attack, that's going to have a difference on the XG scores at the end of the match, and it's going to maybe look like Team A deserved the draw or whatever. But yeah, in terms of the performances of Spurs week to week, they did seem just as inconsistent as they did before he arrived. But I do have general thoughts, though, on that sort of thing. I think he suffered from a lot of injuries and things like that.
What's your opinion on how you think they'll get on this year? I have my own thoughts, but yeah, I'll let you kind of go first. Do you think they're going to have a good campaign?
It's difficult to say, but considering it's still, you know, this is Mourinho's first season in charge, isn't it? Very, very, very rarely does Mourinho have a bad first season in charge of anyone. So I would expect him to do well. I don't know how well. But his initial vision for the team when he first started, I actually really liked. He interpreted the squad sensibly, I thought. Played, I think it was 4-2-3-1, but then with possession, it became a back three. He kept the two in the midfield. And Serge Aurier joined the attacking lineup. So it became a 3-2-4-1 in possession. Obviously, Serge Aurier is a bit of a nutcase. And he's been kind of replaced this summer, really, by Matt Doherty, who's really good on in the attacking areas. I mean, scores goals for the Wolves.
That was a good buy.
Yeah, and they've got Højbjerg in midfield, who's a lot more industrious, I think, than people realise. And I think he'll be really well suited to, say, for example, he's paired with Ndombele, who maybe does a little bit less on the defensive side. You've got a pair in there who compensate for each other's flaws, really. Or maybe if it's not Ndombele, Lo Celso's, you know, very progressive, but maybe needs a bit of the defensive work done for him. So, yeah, I think getting Doherty and Højbjerg in and adding them to the 3-2-4-1 thing that Mourinho had going initially when he had all those players fit. Obviously, you got Dele Alli playing and stuff like that. I did initially have a bit of hope for him, but he's a really hard person to predict. Spurs are a really hard team to predict at the minute. But part of me does think they have got enough there to have a decent campaign. I'm not sure how decent, but yeah, I'm going to look at them with a bit of intrigue this season, I think.
Yeah, you know, I think it's hard to add much more than that. I agree. I thought they bore fairly well. You know, no superstar purchase, not like Ndombele was last year. Although it didn't work out for them, but you know, that felt like a really big buy. You know, there hasn't been none of that, but Højbjerg, Doherty have been good purchases and definitely things that they needed. I think they'll be better for having those two players in the side. Do I think they're going to break the top four? I don't. You know, I can just see them being a kind of top seven side again. But you know, the problem is as well, I think the Premier League is going to be really competitive. This is something else that we've spoke about. You know, the teams are certainly in the top 10. Teams have bought fairly well. They're very settled. You know, a lot of all the managers of most top 10 sides now are, you know, fairly new into their regimes. You know, either haven't been there too long or have been but very comfortable. You think like Klopp and Guardiola, or they've got, you know, maybe first full seasons, if you think of the likes of Ancelotti, Arteta. So it kind of feels like we're going to see a lot of settled clubs at the top end of the table for the next season, which is going to only make these teams better. And I just think for Tottenham's quality in the side, I'm just not sure they'll do enough to kind of close the gap on those sides above. And this is a very, you know, Sky Sports generic statement here. But I do feel like Mourinho has just lost a little bit of his oomph. And I think football is, for all the stuff that we talk about in terms of data and numbers, I do think a lot of it's psychological. And, you know, other clubs he's gone into, he's had that aura, that wow factor. And that, for me, it just feels like it's already subsided so much at Tottenham. And that's a lot of his appeal, in my opinion. I do wonder how much he's going to get out of this side this year. Maybe not having that aspect to his game or his management. Don't know.
Yeah. No, I know what you're saying. Like, I do think that there's an element to what he does, which is kind of a little bit player startup now. I think a lot of players, you know, with the rise of the whole pressing game and all that sort of stuff, I think a lot of players now, they kind of know the brand of football they want to represent, really. And when they get asked by a Mourinho type to, you know, when you get a lead, sit on the lead and just defend for however long it takes, you know, a lot of players now are just kind of, they're not unwilling to do it, but they don't want to do it, really. They want to play a more proactive game. I think Mourinho's very results-driven. All about winning is all that matters and stuff like that, and that does well for him because he does secure results. but sometimes the performances can be a little bit grim, and I think that bothers a lot of players. But
I think it bothers the fans as well, because in our little kind of Twitter bubble we have, you know, we follow a few Tottenham fans, and you see a lot of whinging even when they win, and because they've gone from such a, you know, exciting kind of philosophy under Pochettino, a coach that they loved. Okay, he was sacked, but, you know, it wasn't something that was celebrated by Spurs fans, and they've gone from that being associated with that brand of football to then kind of going to Mourinho, and I don't think they're enjoying it, if I'm being brutally honest.
No, well, this is why he seems to not last particularly long at clubs, because if you have, you know, you've got your results and you've got your performances. Mourinho's performances typically aren't that great, but he gets results, so he stays in the job. If after 3 years those results start to suffer, he has nothing left to fall back on, because the performances are already a bit grim. So if the performances are bad and the results are bad, very quickly it turns very sour with Mourinho. Whereas, say, for example, if a more entertaining coach was to start losing matches, you've still got the performance side to fall back on as like, you know, a reason to keep him in the job, sort of thing.
Yeah, it's a really good point. We'll have a quick chat about the game now before we round up. Obviously, I don't know if you got to watch this game, Josh. These two sides only met about 8 weeks ago, and it was potentially one of the worst football games I've ever watched, if I'm being brutally honest with you. It was settled by way of an own goal, 1-0, but neither side really deserved to win it. I actually remember it was the game where the recent Son had a fight on the pitch pretty much, which kind of, you know, summed up, they were a bit of a mess. You know, Everton showed not enough ambition, but then I won't be too critical because I just think they were just so limited. But it was a poor performance anyway. I do think this could potentially be a big game for Everton. If they were to go and win a game week one, go and win away at a traditional top six side, get that kind of monkey off the back that lingers over them all across the campaign, then I do feel like that could be a springboard for a pretty special season. Obviously, I don't want to get carried away. You know, football is so inconsistent. You could win one week and lose the next. But I do feel like it would, with the field goal factor around the club, that would be a huge win. And I mean, do you agree? What do you think? Am I being too excitable there?
It depends what you mean. is this the part where we preview the actual season expectations?
No, not necessarily. Just the importance of the game, I guess. You know what?
Yeah.
No, do you feel like if Everton were to win that game, I do feel like it'd be a huge springboard. Where if they were to go and lose again, even if it was a valiant defeat, or, you know, it just petered out into a bit of a naff draw, I feel like this enthusiasm could just, I'm not saying people turn, of course they wouldn't, but it'd just take the wind out of the sails a little bit.
Yeah, no, it's that belief, it's that you know, getting up to a good start is definitely a thing. And it can definitely have an impact on certainly the start of your season and how the place that you get yourself attached to for the rest of the season, really. I think usually if you have a bad start, you're out of it, you know, as soon as possible, really. You've only got Manchester City last season.
Yeah.
With eight games played, and even have the title race, really.
Yeah.
Looking back at that Spurs game, by the way, the own goal winner, Everton started with a midfield that day, and I was midfield four, Iwobi, Gomez, Sigurdsson and Davis. Now, could you even guess now who played where?
No, I'd say off the top of my head, oh God, unless you want to break the news to us, I think I've got it. I think I could work it out. But if it's what I think it is, it just shows how bad it was.
Yeah, well, I think what it is that I'm getting at, Davis started on the right on the day, with Sigurdsson to the centre and Iwobi on the left. But you could have had Davis and Sigurdsson there swap places. You could swap Iwobi to the right. You know, you just all kinds you can do with that. It very much is this square peg round hole thing.
Yeah, that saying has never, yeah, that saying has never been more applicable, I think. You know, square pegs, round hole, I think, in that game is just a prime example. And it does kind of make you reflect with a bit more, just a bit more objective, I'd say, you know, because at the time I found the result really frustrating because Everton really on the cusp of breaking into Europe. If they would have won those three games that week, I think it was Tottenham, Southampton and Wolves, or even if they would have picked up 6 points, he probably would have had a good shot of the title, if I wish, of European football. And obviously they lost in a really bad fashion and a boring 1-0 game. But on reflection, you think, you know, look at the team, look at the midfield, it's no surprise. For this game, Josh, we've had James Rodriguez training all week. We've had Alan in there all week. I'm not too sure on the core, actually, because his deal got announced a lot later. I suspect he's only had a couple of days. But I'm just trying to gauge whether you maybe throw them in from the outset. For me, I'd be tempted to be honest. They look fit. Look like they've had a decent pre-season behind them. I don't think any midfielder from last season did enough to be guaranteed a start. So some may call it a risk, but I'd probably include Alan and Rodriguez in the team and maybe Decore from the bench.
Yeah, no, I don't. I think I would as well. I don't think, to be honest, I don't think Ancelotti has much of a choice. Mm. I think it's kind of needs must, really. I think last season, when I think Everton bought a few new players, and Marco Silva had this thing where he was taking a lot of time to bed them in and to give them actual games and stuff like that. That makes a lot of sense if you've already got a really good core and a really good 11. Mm. But when you haven't, the players you bought have to go in pretty quickly. Otherwise, your results will start to suffer. And then you'll start looking at the new players that you bought, who you wanted to give time. You'll start looking at them and throwing them in as a means of, like, please help. So I think from Ancelotti's perspective, obviously, you know, your first game is a waste of spares, not easy. You already don't really have much of a midfield. I don't think he's got much of a choice.
I agree. Yeah, I'd put them in. Certainly two of the three. And so you kind of go. It could be without Mason Holgate, so it might be Bramwaite in there. But you look at the 4-4-2, kind of usual goalkeeper Pickford. You know, back four. Then I'd have maybe Alisson in there with. I don't know. Actually, it's tough. I'll be honest, Josh, if all three could go in, I'd just put all three in. Because then
I would.
Because, okay, so you put Alan in, but who are you putting alongside him? I don't, you know, if Gomez might be injured, he was sent home from international duty, he probably would have been my choice. So then, maybe Sigurdsson in there? It's not great. But we'll see. We'll leave the team selection to Ancelotti on the day when, because he'll obviously know who's available. Have you got any predictions at all for this game, Josh? I know it's really, really, really hard to do, especially this year of all year, but have you got any feeling as to how it might play out?
Yeah, it's a difficult one to predict this. Jose really loses when he's taken over his first game and the first new season and all that sort of stuff. I'm going to go for a draw, I think. I'm going to go 1-1. First game back, no fans. Both managers in kind of, you know, after taking over halfway through last season, this is their first new campaign. They're both aware it's not the easiest fixture. So I think it might be relatively cautious.
I'm also going to go 1-1. But a much better game than the one we watched 8 weeks ago. But we'll wait and see. We'll round off very quickly. Josh, if you had to, I won't ask for a specific position. I'll let you get away with a band of around, you know, two or three. I'll give you mine first. If you had to try and predict where you think Everton might finish this season based on the limited knowledge we have so far, I'm kind of looking at between sixth and eighth, personally. But have you got any other reservation? And by all means, don't forget, honesty, best policy. Don't feel like you have to appease the listeners.
Yeah. To be honest, I think if Everton finish above eighth, I think they've had an incredible season. And the reason I think that is because if you look at last year, they finished 12th with a goal difference of minus 12. Usually, if you look at the goal difference, it kind of plays out in terms of position throughout the whole, most of the league. Like, say, for example, the team that finished 8th were Arsenal with a goal difference of plus 8. Sheffield United, 9th with a goal difference of 0. So if Everton have finished the season on minus 12, you know, they've got to shave 12 goals off there just to break even. And then they've got to add maybe another 8 to get to Arsenal's level. And that's Arsenal with Arteta only taking over half the season. So I think Everton, to finish around 8th, need to have about 20, to be about 20 goals better off. Not only on the attacking side, on the defensive side as well. Now, James Rodriguez, Doucouré and Allan, three good players. Are they adding 20 goals to you on the attacking and defensive side? Maybe, you know, it's possible. And if they do get to that point, Everton, for me, finish around 8th, and I think that'll be a great season. I think that's progression. Go and do it a bit better next year. And, yeah, and just keep improving that way. But if Everton finish above 8th, I won't be shocked or surprised, but I think it will be a great performance in comparison to last year.
Yeah, you'd be impressed, should we say. You'd be impressed if you finished above 8th, yeah. Yeah, okay. No, that's fair. We'll wait and see. We'll round off the show. It was good to be back. The reality is we don't know when the next one will be because they're kind of semi-regular, but we'll try and keep that up. It won't be as long as last time, obviously. We just had to deal with the consequences of the COVID outbreak and the impact on our working environments. But we've kind of juggled that now, haven't we, Josh? We have, with other shows, and we know what we're doing. So we'll try and catch up and have another show soon. But thanks for listening in. Hope we enjoyed it, and we'll chat again soon. Cheers, Josh.
Cheers, mate.
You've been listening to the Royal Blue Podcast from the Liverpool Echo.